Hello, you, and welcome to You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies. Today, we are talking about Bones and All. We are talking about it with our great friend, Kevin Allison. I'm one of your hosts, Alex Steed, and I will soon be joined by my marvelous co-host, Sarah Marshall. Hey, super quick note before we jump in, just in case you skip these intros, there's a longer version of this episode by like 20 to 30 minutes longer, available to our Patreon and Apple podcast subscribers. Just want to give you a heads up about that before you dive in further. Know that this is one of my favorite conversations. So you can get a substantial amount more over in bonus land. Bones and All is a 2022 romantic horror film directed by Luca Guadagnino. It is based on the 2015 novel Bones and All by Camille DeAngelis. It's set in the late 1980s. It stars Taylor Russell and Timothée Chalamet as a pair of young cannibals who flee together on a road trip across the United States of America and develop feelings for each other. Kevin Allison is an American comedian, a writer, an actor, a storyteller. He's a writing and performing member of the comedy troupe The State, extraordinarily formative to and for me, and a lot of people like me. This is there is no debate that a reason why I got into all of the things that I got into is because of The State. The State, in so many ways, feels like 40% of how I got here. So I appreciate Kevin so much. And then not only that, Kevin hosts and has hosted Risk, the storytelling podcast, for years and years. Kevin is an old school podcaster. Kevin's been in the game for a long time. It's incredible. I was fortunate to tell a story at Risk once, and I loved it. Loved being a part of it. I hope to be a part of it again someday soon. If you have Risk events in your area, go check them out. You'll love them. If you like the show, you'll love that. And if you're not listening to Risk, listen to Risk. How are you doing? How's it going in your world? What is happening? What are you thinking about? What are you reading? What are you feeling? What are you watching? Tell us over at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod, depending on the social channel that you're on. We're probably on it. Whatever it is, you can find us at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod. Let us know what's on your mind. And don't forget that you, my friend, you are good. I recently saw a short film that premiered in Los Angeles. I saw a short film by the filmmaker Alex Farias. I hope that I'm saying that right. Alex Farias, perhaps. It was called Beatrix is Invisible. I don't think this is shown at festivals yet. I think that this was its sort of initial launch. It's going to show at festivals, but it starred the great Ellen Green, stars the great Ellen Green. Ellen Green was in the room and is a slight person with the energy and projected size of like Shaquille O'Neal. Well, maybe more energy than Shaquille O'Neal, but just like is a giant. I was just in awe of being around Ellen Green. You can hear us talk about our love for Green in our Little Shop of Horrors episode so much. And this performance that Green delivers, which is a performance about aging and invisibility and finding power in the face of feeling small and unseen, was marvelous. Please keep an eye out for it. If it shows at a festival or whatever, or whenever it's available for you to view, check it out. I realize I'm giving you an item that you can't take action on right now, but just know about it. I have no incentive to say any of this. I don't know the person who made it. I just loved it, and I've been thinking about it since. It's really been on my mind. And again, Green's performance was just exquisite. You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies, is made possible with and by your support. Thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon and Apple Podcast subscriptions. We have a new bonus episode. If it's not up right now, it'll be out very soon, about Mannequin that we recorded with our great friend River Butcher. There's also an extended cut version of this conversation about Bones and All, because we had a great chat. We had a long, good chat. We couldn't fit it all into the main feed episode. I think the bonus episode is like 20 or more minutes longer than this episode. I love it. I think this is one of my favorite conversations that we've ever had. It doesn't hurt that it's one of my favorite people with a hero. But yeah, if you want more, you can find that over in Bonus Land at Patreon and Apple Podcast subscriptions. If you, like me, are in favor of a ceasefire, like appears to be some progress in that arena, at least with regard to world's demand, find actions in and around your neighborhood if you can. If you're able to offer any financial support, the Palestine Children's Relief Fund is a great place to start, and we have a link to that in the show notes. All right, I think that's it for our introduction to Bones and All. I think that's all you need to know. I'm trying to think of any content warnings. I mean, we talk about cannibalism. We talk about gore. Kind of here and there, we talk about grooming just a little bit. We mentioned the word molestation, but not in the context that it's usually known in. I just want to give you a heads up on that. And I think that that's it. I'm pretty sure that that's it. But, you know, as always, listen to the episodes with care. But I think that's the warning for this particular episode. All right, without further ado, let's chew on a finger. Let's get into it. Let's talk Bones and All with Kevin Allison. Hello, Sarah Marshall.
Hello, Alex Steed. I'm a cannibal.
Have you seen my 8-foot braid lying around here somewhere?
Let me tell you, as someone who is not generally grossed out by blood and guts, but is grossed out by piles of hair, this movie was a delight and a challenge. Alex, your 8-foot braid is in my house where you left it.
We're covering Bones and All, which I watched last year. I loved two mm-hmm. movies last year, not because there were only two good movies that came out, but because we watched 50 movies here and I watch what mm-hmm. I can elsewhere. I loved The Iron Claw so much, which mm-hmm. was about boys loving each other. And I loved Bones and All so mm-hmm. much. It feels to me like this really, and I can't wait to talk about it, this inverted version of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre that I am stoked to get into, which is a movie that we love.
God, that's so true. It's about owls.
Yeah. It's like, what if the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was quiet?
And it is when there isn't a chainsaw going.
And when I brought it up to our dear friend, Kevin Allison, he saw some interesting things in it that I was like, well, that'll make this conversation even more fascinating. Kevin.
Hello.
Kevin, could there be a subtext?
I think Alex tricked both of us into this. You said to me on Twitter, you got to watch Bones and All. When I watched it, I knew nothing, not who directed it, who was in it, or what it was about. And so it really...
Yep.
Grab you by the finger.
Yes, indeed. Oh my goodness. Yeah. But as soon as there was that element to it where I was like, oh, I can relate to parts of this from, you know, just growing up and all, you know, things started to change. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I didn't mean to trick you, but I was like, if there's someone who I think will enjoy this. And then when I saw you like reference it after the fact, I was like, okay, it landed in some way.
Mm-hmm. My pamphlet has been read and assimilated. I've saved another soul from the lake of fire.
Kevin, how do people know you? How do people know you? What are you known for?
Well, I have a podcast called Risk, where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share in public. We have had a couple of cannibalism stories on.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, and so this movie is about cannibalism, and that's something that I find so exciting, because I think we're going to be talking throughout about the great hierarchy of vampire films, of which I believe cannibalism films are a subset, and there is nothing queerer than a vampire movie, in my opinion.
No, absolutely. And for a movie that's like exploring these themes, and there are really unsettling parts to watch, even though, again, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, there's not like giant full-on gory scenes. There's just enough to unsettle you.
And then some beautiful landscapes.
And some gorgeous landscapes, some great 80s vibes music-wise. Yeah. It is somehow absolutely delicately lovely, ineffective as a love story and like as a first love story in ways that like typically when vampire stories do this, there's something about the affect and aesthetic of like the eroticism piece that like takes me out of the love.
Because you don't relate to them because they're so fancy. Vampires are so often fancy, which is why Near Dark is such an important movie. And I think uncle of this movie.
I love that, the idea of it being the uncle of this movie. And there's something about first love that we see replicated in crushes for the rest of our lives that is related to infatuation, in which you just want to consume, right? Like you want to like consume the thing or person or whatever that you're into and have them be a part of you. And so we get that here. It's so good. I fucking love it. Sarah Marshall.
Yes.
What's Bones and All about?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So I'll start also by saying that in 2015, I finished writing a probably unpublishable novel, which is very similar to this movie on many counts. It was about a teenage cannibal vampire who has a father figure who like abandons her the first chance he can. She's like looking for love. It's the 80s, but she's in LA and she meets someone who's clearly just the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez. So this movie, I think, is actually a much more constructive approach to the subject matter. And I say this because I believe these are like, I mean, by sheer math, like two completely unrelated projects, because this movie is based on a book that was published in 2015 and which I'm excited to read. But that there's like some kind of universal grammar of vampires that goes, I think, even beyond culture, with this idea of like consuming and being consumed and needing to live by eating, and there being some kind of ethical compromise in that, and also kind of a spirituality and an erotics to consuming the flesh. That's just like baked into us, or else so many people wouldn't take communion. See in Bruges episode. But anyway, Bones and All is about a teenage girl who has the exact same bangs as the friend of the first victim in The Silence of the Lambs. We know that this was intentional, which I love. I've loved those bangs my whole life. And she lives with her father. They move around a lot. He's secretive. He won't let her socialize. And so at the start, you're like, oh, yeah, this is a movie about a girl who's kind of different. And then she learns how to meet friends. Okay. You're kind of settling in, right? You're enjoying your popcorn. And then she sneaks out and goes to a sleepover with a girl who she's kind of friends with, but keeping at a little bit of a distance. And you're like, ooh, is it like, does she have like a crush on her? Where are we going? And then she tries to eat her finger, just tries to bite it clean off. I guess she just kind of loses track of herself for a second. And like, Kevin, is someone going in completely cold? What was that like for you?
Oh my gosh, that was such a shock. The first thing that occurred to me was, I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, I remember how straight people don't realize that sleepovers are so loaded for gay kids, you know? Yeah. I had so much fun at some sleepovers when I was younger. But yeah, then when it turned into biting the finger, I was like, oh, this is what we're in for now. So then I'm in the horror movie vibe, right? But then so much more starts to happen.
The beautiful thing about how that scene works is there's not 1 second that separates like where it goes from being like giving into like a little eroticism or like sort of like being interested in your friend in a sexual way when the finger is in the mouth because of how they are the entire time to the bite. So like you are caught entirely off guard by how that happens in a way that I feel like feels resonant to when you first have like initial sexual experiences that maybe are not the ones that you are supposed to have.
Yeah.
Well, there are some sleepovers where you'll get better treatment for trying to bite someone's finger off than for kissing them, you know?
Yes.
And people have lived to tell the tale and probably also packed up and moved in the middle of the night. So she makes a run for it. Our main character, whose name I forget.
Marin.
Marin. Yeah.
Marin. Which nobody was named in the 80s, but whatever. People were named it. There's a county named it. Different spelling, though. It's fine. Marin Yearly, which is so good. And there's a part later on where, spoiler, her mother, played by, spoiler, Chloe Sevigny, has written her a letter.
By New York it girl.
Yeah.
Chloe Sevigny.
That's right.
She's like, good evening, Marin. It's me, Chloe. And it has recently come to my attention that I am a cannibal. But she calls her Little Yearly. And I was just like, Chloe Sevigny would name her child Little Yearly. First name Little, middle name Yearly.
This is true.
But Marin Yearly, she and her father have to jam in the middle of the night. It's just like slums of Beverly Hills. It is the year of our Lord, 1988. They pack up and move to Maryland. And then pretty soon after that, he just fucks off and abandons her anyway. And he's left her a tape that is either, I know it's not really long, she's just taking her sweet time listening to it, but she's listening to it for the whole movie.
The whole movie.
Which makes you think he was out there on the porch recording this thing for like 10 hours. The paperboy came by, you know?
It's like literally any email from me is you're like, this is too many fucking words. Why?
Where it's like, when in the course of human events?
I'll keep coming back to this throughout the year.
And I'll always find new wisdom. Yeah, it's like a big canister of tea, you know? But he's basically like, dear Marin, you first attacked a human being when you were 3 years old. So, yeah, so there does feel like so much allegory in this movie. And one of them is that he's like, I've been watching you since you were a toddler. And we always had to move around so people didn't catch on about the way that you are.
Mm.
And this is also the way your mother was. And here's your birth certificate, which I was watching and I was like, where's my birth certificate? Isn't it crazy that the government just hands you a piece of paper when you're born and is like, keep that forever.
Don't lose it.
Yeah.
Don't lose it.
You know, it's hard to lose a piece of paper, famously. That's never happened. And then, you know, and if you're a young vampire, you can use it as proof of age to get a bus ticket to Columbus, Ohio, because you're trying to go to Menominee, Wisconsin or something to track down your mother. Or I guess it's where she was born. I don't know. Something. She has to get to the region. And so she can only get as far as Ohio. And there she meets Mark Rylance, who I think is giving it his best Harry Dean Stanton.
Wow.
That's great.
Right?
That's great. Yeah, like a faggy Harry Dean Stanton. Like, I feel like that was the direction.
They were like, Harry Dean Stanton is dead. So tonight, Mark Rylance will be playing the role of Harry Dean Stanton.
And as a result, again, I don't mean to keep drawing parallels. Like, this is a long lost Sawyer family member from Texas Chainsaw.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Oh.
Like, this guy is like, if one of them left and like maybe tried to go to college or something, like, there's just something about him that is spectacular and otherworldly. One of my favorite, not just horror performances, but one of my favorite performances of all time. Kevin, how would you describe this person?
Sully, famously.
Sully.
You know, what's so interesting to me about Sully is that I've never felt so much sympathy and empathy for a villain. You know what I mean? Like I kind of don't trust anything he says. You know, I kind of second guess everything he says, except when he talks about how lonely and hard his life has been. You know, then I'm like, yeah, I really buy that. You know, like, all of the adults in the movie are clearly traumatized. And the two kids in the movie are trying to figure out how to, you know, not end up so fucked up as the adults in their lives. And like, he's, I guess, ostensibly the best, you know, like he's trying to present an ethical cannibalism to them.
He'll at least stick around, you know. Ultimately too much, but
he also is like that character, and I know that this manifests for a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. It especially manifests for like a lot of like queer young people, is like that there's like an elder who introduces you to things that like your parents aren't introducing you to, like a patchwork code based on their life, like not necessarily based on like what's good or logical or right, but it's like, this is what's kept me alive so far. And sometimes the relationship is super inappropriate.
Right, exactly. That can tip over into like grooming. Or, you know, the way he goes so quickly to... I was nice. Mm-hmm. I was trying to be nice to you and helpful to you. And like, he becomes very like, I deserve for right. you to be my partner or something like that. Yeah. He clearly like does have some like, I don't know, earned wisdom to share with her, you know, but at the same time, he's so creepy.
Oh yeah, and you know, great choice of underwear posture. Oh, the feeding scene is really beautiful, and all the kind of across the board for this whole movie, something I really appreciated about it is just like the clothes people are wearing are clearly based not on like TV shows and fashion magazines of the 80s, but like pictures of real people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And the interiors and the way everything looks. You know, we've drifted so far into this kind of exaggerated version of the 80s, which, as my mom complains about with period pieces in the 50s specifically, because that's when she grew up, but it's true of every era. It's bad art direction to be like, everyone in this movie just bought all new furniture this year, and they bought all new clothes this year, right. and they're listening to all new music this year. And it's like, people don't do that. And a tweet that Alex, I remember you sent me once that I always think of is somebody being like, filmmakers underestimate how brown the 80s were.
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. It's such a beautiful, and the Rust Belt aspect yeah. to it. Just all these places that feel kind of a little bit discarded or just mm-hmm. not very well cared for.
And extra in the past and all. And there's so much peeling paint. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we're taking, this movie is set in, you know, Virginia, Maryland, Ohio, Kentucky, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Like, there is no real America, but that is the real America. It's the part that got abandoned first. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he does a little exposition for us. He's like, you're an eater. I can smell an eater from half a mile away. And I have a code. I never eat an eater. And I can smell someone who's near death. And then I go into their house and feed on them. And again, this was something that I had been writing about in this kind of piece of juvenilia about, and it was very much through thinking about these kind of universal themes in American life of like, how does one eat ethically? And it's like, well, if you're a cannibal and you wait until somebody's dead and then you go eat them, then like, you know, something's gonna eat you once you're dead. Might be the best way to do it. The supply chain is very short. And they feed, and he tells her about her condition, which is that she hasn't eaten very much human flesh yet, but she's going to need two more as she grows up. What's interesting too, and that I don't think this ever comes up in this movie, is that normally with vampirism, there's this idea of like, you've made this bargain with the devil where you can, you know, you'll never grow old, Michael, and you'll never die, but you must feed. And these guys are just mortals. There's no sweet side of the bargain for them. They just got to eat people.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. It's so funny that that's the deal.
It's just a recessive trait. It's like being a redhead.
Yeah, exactly. Like Marin didn't get like stuck at 18 forever. She's just like on her journey and has to live a life of this.
Yeah. And she's probably around now. She's just like 55. She probably has like a job, you know, doing tech support for somewhere.
She's being a person.
So yeah, she learns the ground rules and then she's like, okay, I'm gonna go. And then she just like bolts and gets on a bus. But what does she see but Sully standing there looking creepy and forlorn? Mm-hmm. Never good. As the bus pulls away, and pretty soon she, while doing some light shoplifting, runs into Timothy Chalamet, who's also an eater. Which is so great because he's cute. And she meets him when he's escorting a guy out of a store where he does not work, who he's caught also stealing. And does he, what happens to that guy?
He kills that guy.
Okay.
Yeah, he kills him and eats him a bit. And on the outside, he says to Marin something along the lines of like, he's like 30 feet beyond that thing. If you, implying like if she wants to get in on it, he's over there.
Yeah, if you want a snack.
Exactly.
Because that guy was bullying some woman in that store. So I think that was his, yeah, he deserves He's a creep.
Yeah, we're playing by Hannibal Jigsaw rules here, where if someone is rude in public, you're allowed to eat them.
Yes.
Which is, you know, it can get out of hand quickly.
Well, and it's kind of also just like Lee's, it will be like his thing for the rest of the movie. It's like his whole character is protect your sister from your drunk dad. And our first introduction to him is protect this random mother from loudmouth asshole who I think has a Reagan bumper sticker, which is backed up by a 80s boob job topless lady poster in his apartment.
Yeah, that issue I think is really interesting, though, that Chalamet's character doesn't bother with the whole a person would be near death, right?
No. Well, he says to her, everyone has their rules. That's not one of mine.
Right. And with Sully, like, I kind of doubt that he sticks to his rules also, just because I don't really trust most of what Sully says, you know?
Well, not to give anything away, but we know he doesn't. I mean, he later transgresses on his who is on the menu, so to speak. But I like this. I mean, this is like the... You know, I think a thing a lot of people have problems with regard to like what the internet settled into, particularly with regard to, quote, discourse around like issues of queerness, discourse around issues of feminism, et cetera, it feels increasingly like there's an orthodoxy, which in many ways feels contrary to like what the whole point was necessarily in the first place. And it's very easy to accidentally or unintentionally fall on the wrong side of the orthodoxy. It's very easy also to fake adherence to the orthodoxy as a means of sort of establishing audience, et cetera, et cetera. And what we see in that, just that small part where it's like everyone has their rules, that's not one of mine, is every group, particularly in 1988, you can see this as like Gus Van Sant drugstore cowboy junkie logic. You can see this as just like every group of two or three friends is its own culture within queer community stuff, or sort of like everyone has like these kind of sets of rules which establish like their culture or agreement with how they interface in the world. And there isn't yet this kind of like grand idea that is all shared among everybody. And it's either like very right or very wrong.
Right.
Because I know that there are like but there are real camps of people who like this movie based on what they believe it's speaking to. And there are people who are like, I was on another show talking about this and I was like, yeah, this is all like, at the very least, like queer allegory. And they were like, no, this is addiction.
Oh yeah, I kind of love the fact that any one analogy, you know, it doesn't stick all the way to, you know, that it's very flexible that way.
Sure.
You know, that it can be somewhat addiction or eating disorder or coming to terms with being queer and kinky, or even the harm reduction, you know, questions of, okay, we want to do this or feel an instinctual pull to do this, but how to do it, how to go about doing it.
Right. Absolutely. Or is it as simple as saying, you know, quote, like we're right in middle, we're at the end of Reagan times going into Bush times, like what is existence that goes beyond a simple binary of like, just say no. Like that's like what everyone is sort of dealing with in one way or another.
Right. That's another. Yeah, absolutely.
Totally. Yeah. You know, and so they bond and he's a drifter, but he needs to go home to Kentucky to take his little sister for a driving lesson, which is so fucking cute. And then he's like, I'll take you to see your mom. And so they go, he's like, we'll see the world. Well, you know, at least Missouri and Minnesota. We'll see America.
The other thing that I'm sorry to cut you off there, but like when they go back to this guy's apartment, there's an extremely unnecessary but wonderful scene where he finds Kisses Lick It Up.
I think it is necessary.
And no, I agree. I do agree. I mean, like on page, it's someone must have been like, do we need to put this in there? And the guy's like, yeah, absolutely. And I love this scene where he just like walks around dancing to that so much. And then the next and only song he sings is George Strait's Amarillo by Morning. And it really just speaks to like what was going on musically at this time in the 80s. It's like, you knew like 30 songs and that's it.
And it was really decided by whoever was choosing what went on the radio in your town.
Exactly.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they're on their Great American Road Trip. They're just two cute cannibals falling in love on the road. And so they get up. Well, first they... This movie is a lot like Crossroads, right? Because it's about a girl traveling across America to find her mother. Mm-hmm. And so first, Maren finds her grandmother, who is played by Jessica Harper.
Can you believe it?
No, I'm obsessed with her. I've been obsessed with her since I was like 15.
I didn't even realize it until this second viewing.
Oh, right.
I was like, oh my gosh, it's the Suspiria gal.
The Suspiria gal.
Directed by the Suspiria remake guy. So fun.
She's great. And so, yeah, it's lovely to see her here. And she's like, your mother is no longer with us. And she's like, well, you know, she's alive, but she's living the good life, being guarded by a very helpful nurse in a nice mental health facility where she did chew off both of her hands.
Oh, my God. Mm.
Like Lloyd's bunny in The Stand. And... the only part of this movie, honestly, that felt sort of like, okay, this is a bit much in terms of reality, but also I don't care and I'm not complaining.
Is it the letter?
It's not the letter. It's the nurse who's just like, hello.
Oh, right.
Your mother's been waiting for you for 15 years. She wrote this letter. Here it is right now. I have it available to you to read.
I agree entirely. It was so sort of convenient, but we may need to let listeners know, particularly younger listeners, that at this time in American history, some people had jobs that lasted for more than 5 years at most. Like some people would get a job at a place and they'd never have to find another one.
And also sometimes you had a pair of shoes that lasted for longer than 5 years at most. That's even weirder, am I right? Exactly. Now you buy a pair of sneakers, they fall apart in 5 months. You're like, we had a good run. We had a good life together.
Some people had jobs for so long that they had institutional memory and they would remember that when this particular person showed up, there was a letter put on file 15 years ago.
Totally.
Well, and also I guess the fact that like out of the monsters that bureaucracy makes out of everyone who has to work in it, that like it's not someone in like teddy bear scrubs who's like, please stand behind the line. It's just this nice woman who explains everything. As we've discussed, Maren's mother is played by Chloe Sevigny. And so, and I love this movie. I think it's perfect. And there are also, because a movie is a movie, there are elements that, yeah, the letter too, where they like give her the letter. And the letter is like a James Bond villain speech by the end. Like, Alex, can you talk about it?
Yeah, we hear it in Chloe. We hear it in Chloe's voice that, and also like in the affect of her clear having come off the rails at some point. So it's being read by a person who is not doing well.
Yeah.
But in Maren's head, this is what she's hearing.
All jokes aside, I think she's great in this.
Yes, no, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
In Maren's head, it essentially says, if you're here, this is because your father broke his promise, meaning the father likely promised to not tell Maren sort of like what the what her history is, or at least where the mother is.
Mm-hmm.
You're here because you've figured stuff out. I love you and I love your father, and it's been torture that I can't be around you, but it's something along the lines of like, the only freedom we will ever have is like being in a place with like doors with locks. And and to your point of like the sort of the villain origin speech, she's explaining how her heart got broken and why she is in this state and why she has done some things to protect Maren. And one of those things is that she's gonna kill her. I don't exactly know what the culmination is.
Yeah, she's like, if you're reading this letter right now, I'm already about to fucking kill you. And it's like, maybe don't put that in your letter.
Do you think she wrote the letter and then like read it in her head and timed, counted the timing? So when she's like, okay, when the letter goes in Maren's hand, 1, 2, 3, and then launches.
And that'll be awkward because you've never met your daughter and you don't know what, you know, how fast she reads, because that varies a lot between people. I'm a very slow reader, you know? So she might be starting to lunge and then I'd be like, I'm actually at the start of the third paragraph right now. I don't know what this is about.
Hold the lunge, Mom.
Kevin, how does this scene read to you?
Well, It's so nerve-wracking. There are so many scenes like this in the movie where there's tense music building and you're not sure what this person is going to be all about. And, you know, it kind of makes no sense that her mother attacks. I mean, you know, she could only get so far.
She's like, I'm going to make sure I attack you when a psychiatric nurse is in the room who's been trained to deal with this very instance.
It is really great. Like our show was called Why Our Dads, where we deconstructed the roles of our fathers in our lives and what that means and masculinity, et cetera. So many people were like, you should do a spinoff show called Why Our Moms, about all of our people who have issues with their moms. And this movie's for you.
And I was like, no, because my mom listens to podcasts.
Right.
This movie's for you. We have a girl who has issues with her mom and we have a guy who has issues with his dad and they go on a road trip together.
That's right.
Because she is left with that feeling, that extremely conflicted. I love this scene that takes place after this. Like, I agree with every criticism you have of this scene. It's so, and I adore this movie.
And it's not a real criticism because I don't want it to be different. It's just like, it's just a delight.
It is a delight. And it's where it feels the most, like, this is like, to me, this is like, quote, prestige horror without being prestige. Like, it never feels to me like it's like, look at us be better. Like, it's just is a good movie. But this is one scene that feels like a little like Malignant, where you're like, all right.
Exactly.
But I love the scene that takes place after, which this scene makes possible, where she is obviously sort of icked and freaked out by what just happened and is also reconciling feeling that, you know, she already knows she was in her head, in her read, quote, abandoned by her mother. And now knowing that she exists somewhere and she didn't die, and also she had a bunch of knowledge that Marin believes, based on where she is right now, could have helped her in specific ways.
Right.
She has to like immediately recalibrate her feeling that she was abandoned. And then you have Chalamet being like, you actually kind of, which no one wants to hear while they're having this realization.
Right.
You actually have it pretty easy compared to how it can go, because he has his whole set of things.
That's what you say at like the Denny's the day after your girlfriend's mom tries to kill her.
Right. Precisely. This is the thing. This is a sign of maturity.
Right.
Is when you learn that in the moment isn't necessarily the time to say everything you have on your mind. But yeah, we have that conflict kind of between the two of them, of two people who are trying to sort these things out.
And it's also kind of interesting that the mother presents this final act of trying to eat her daughter as an act of love.
Again, they always do.
Yeah.
Men have never understood the amount of emotional bloodshed that happens between mothers and their daughters. And the number of murders that don't happen is remarkable.
The number of times no one gets eaten.
Yeah, exactly.
Physically.
Yeah, it's a delight.
We get a mirror of this scene a little bit later in a thing we'll sort of talk about in the plot point, but like when she sees Sully later, you know, she says something along the lines to him of like, it's weird that you followed me this far. And he says this perfect line, which is like, never feels true when you hear it when you're young and can't possibly feel true, but then it really feels true of being 40 plus at least, where he says, life will get weirder. I promise.
That's true. I didn't think that was true when I was a teenager. I was like, and to an extent, teenagers are right, because they at least have legal rights as adults. But then the ways that the world does violence to you with that justification kind of outbalances it.
Yeah, it's like, particularly with my friends who are like, you know, at least a decade younger, I'm like, and they're like, oh, this year has been really tough, or like whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, this year has been really tough. Are they all? And it's like, yeah. They're all going to be tough. And I don't mean that in a shitty, and especially now, like, everything's getting tougher in a broad way.
Yeah.
There will be ways that you get stronger, for sure. And there will be ways that, like, you gain wisdom and learn to breathe and all this other stuff happens. But, like, yeah, it just gets weirder. It doesn't get easier.
Do you think that's why Hugh Hefner surrounded himself with young women? Because that's one of the only, aside from the obvious reasons, because it's one of the only ways to ensure that your friends won't keep dying on you.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. That's another thing that I felt sorry for Sully about, is that in younger, older relation, even though they don't have an affair. He wants there to be sort of a romantic relationship there, I think. And younger people are able to walk away from relationships so much more easily. And I feel like an older person like him is, oh my God, here's my chance, you know, to have someone.
Yeah. Yeah. It's brutal. Yeah. So there's this scene, and I'm sorry to reset us, but like there is this scene before, I think this scene takes place before they see the mom. Yeah. Because this is where those two end up going their separate ways, is the title of the movie comes from this phrase, bones and all, which is derived from a again, these people, Texas Chainsaw energy.
Oh, very much.
A serious Texas Chainsaw Man.
A serious Texas Chainsaw Man. These are classic, like, people who listen to the show know I grew up in like Western, kind of like central Western Maine, or it's difficult to say where it is, near the New Hampshire border.
Near all those absolute maniacs in New Hampshire.
These guys are of the flavor of people you would like meet at a woods party there, where you're like, everyone's like kind of a sweet ne'er-do-well, and then just like a couple people are menacing in a way you can't quite put your finger on, but you absolutely know you do not want to get trapped out there with them.
Yeah.
And not even for like orthodox, you don't want to get trapped out there with them reasons. It's like for reasons you may find out about and don't know about yet, but like you never want to know.
Absolutely.
It's interesting, and I don't really know how to read this still, and I've seen this so many times, but like to this point, all the people who are quote afflicted with whatever they're going through are trying to find ways to reconcile the quote evil that they have to do in order to survive, and figure out their relationship with it. And as I understand it, this plays much more heavily into the book, into the conclusion of the book, than that sort of battle. One of the last lines we will hear from Chalamet later is like, am I bad?
Right.
Marin has this question when they have to take down a carny who we find out has like a wife and kid at home, although it was okay when they thought he was just a random gay guy.
Like, my God, I never imagined a carny might have children.
Yeah, he didn't have a car seat. He just wanted to get jerked off in a cornfield. Like, who does it? Who among us? And so everyone's asking that question, but then they meet these guys who they don't care. And not only do they not care, they're like extremely boastful about what their relationship is to this. And also, one of the guys doesn't have to do this.
Right.
Like, one of the guys is just like interested in participating because it's fascinating. And that really tests our limit as audience members about being like, when is it okay, like, if you have to survive, but like it's real fucked up that this guy just wants to be part of the culture, I guess.
Yeah, well, that Marin like can't even continue with the conversation. She has to get up and go back to the car when she finds out about the guy who does it just for kicks.
Right, because she's her issue is like she's so haunted by what she has to do that like to meet this externalized version of it that is doing it for no other reason. And I outside of the piece that it reminds me of with regard to like infatuation and crushes and love and stuff like that, that's so big about part of like young relationships, I still can't really wrap my head around like what the significance of the bones and all thing is. Cause like the boastful cannibal says of his friend that he hasn't even done bones and all yet. And they're like, what is that? Like, it's like lingo that everyone knows.
That's when you make broth.
He says, oh, it's like there's before bones and all and after, which is like before you eat a person from head to toe.
It's a metaphor for anal.
It's getting to fourth or fifth base, whatever it is.
It's fisting. I think I read that as like in terms of where this movie is going and consumption as an act of love, that like the same way that mothers kind of nibble on their babies, right? That like one of the first ways that we're shown we're loved is by the first person we ever recognize pretending to eat us, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And that there's no better way to show Timothy Chalamet he's good than just by eating him bones and all.
Right. Right.
Because then he's all good, even his bones. So that's what you should do with our listeners.
Right.
People think that they're getting the maximum bang for their buck by you saying that they're good. But what if you were eating them one by one?
Yeah, there's just as like scenes go, I feel like this should have been nominated for Best Rando Creep.
Oh yeah,
award for the Academy Awards.
You should start having your own Academy Awards.
I really should.
Going to be better categories.
These guys just really did it for me. This scene really did it for me. And then when she leaves, you know, the wannabe cannibal says something along the lines of like, clearly she was upset, and good thing she has you. And then our boastful cannibal says something along the lines of like, it's him who needs the help. Like, we can see it in you. You remind me of every junkie I've ever met. Like, you think you have it all together, but just like one thread goes and you're all gone.
Right. Almost as if he had been that way himself at one point.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And now he's this very natural way
of just being a rando creep. Yeah. You've yet to find your rando creepiness.
Oh my God. Well, thanks for journeying into the woods with me on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after they find mom, they go their separate ways.
Yeah. You know, and then who should turn up again but good old Sully, who's like, listen, come live with me and be my love and also my daughter, I guess. And she's like, no. And he's like, responds with great equanimity. Just kidding. He's very angry and he drives off angrily.
Yeah, and he does that thing where like he's being very kind and lovely and sweet. And then when she says no, he calls her a cunt, which I feel like is like extremely
real. Yes.
Textbook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's like real, and like it feels like a similar shift to like the fingers in the mouth and it's cute, and then the fingers getting bitten.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, there's so many great horror movies to be made, and this is one of them that we have in front of us about the actual horrors people have in their lives. And him being the figure of most menace, it isn't because he's a cannibal, it's because he's just a guy. He's just some guy. But then, you know, things take a turn because Marin goes to Lee's hometown and finds his sister and kind of gets some of the backstory. Which she knows that he was accused of killing his dad, basically. He was almost accused, but the police just held him for a while and were like, okay. And
because they couldn't find the bones.
Wow.
So, you know, it's also just tactical. And so she goes to find him where he's living in a tent, and he tells her his origin story.
Yeah, the dad had been, oh God, I can't quite remember this.
You're talking about Lee's dad, right?
Yeah.
Who had been an eater himself, right?
Right. And who was coming for Lee. And so Lee, instead of killing him outright, like taped him up and put him in the barn to just kind of slowly die on his own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And ate him in the end as well. Yeah.
You know, and the problem with that is that it's like using a glue trap.
Oh my God.
Right. You know, because like the thing of like glue traps are inhumane because it means you're like, I didn't kill a mouse. I just let a mouse die very painfully while stuck to something in a protracted fashion. So it saves you from feeling like the bad guy. I'm very passionate about glue traps. And so, yeah, this is the thing that Lee has been carrying with him and that's been haunting him. And he needs to be told that he's good.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating?
And then once the secret is out, then they can have a little life together. And then they go to Ann Arbor, which is where all people transitioning from being itinerant cannibals go to try out, you know, growing some roots.
I love that scene. I forget exactly what said. I don't like how it's recorded. This is such a weird tension to have. But they have that ADR issue where like the audio doesn't sound like the rest of the movie.
Oh, right.
But where they're essentially saying like, what do you want to do? Where do you want to go? Like, let's try to go be normal people, have jobs. Let's go be people. It's very cute. And then we see them in their Ann Arbor apartment, you know, cooking. He's talking to his sister on the phone.
He's reading Clan of the Cave Bear.
Oh, right. My
God. Things are adorable for all of like 3 minutes.
Which also Clan of the Cave Bear is great because it's about someone who's different being raised by a different kind of human.
Oh, that's great.
So yeah, things are nice for 3 minutes, which is so nice because I do feel like in sad love stories, it would be nice to see people creating some memories together, if only in a montage.
Yeah. The last movie we all discussed together was Blue Velvet. And it feels, the Ann Arbor sequence, including the voiceover that leads to it, feels a little bit like, wait, is this happiness real? Or, you know, how seriously do we take this? Including maybe even like the final shot of like, is Maren going to be okay? You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is the thing that just feels so much like the relationships at this time or relationships, period, where it's like you have that initial phase of infatuation where you're like pumped full of chemicals that are basically making you mentally ill in a sweet way. Mm-hmm. And then you have to figure out how to exist after that.
Well, I guess keep checking people, obviously. And in the fall, I'll ditch her because she's my summer girl.
And either you realize that like you have another thing that you can do together, or you get stuck together for some period of time. And, you know, that's kind of, we don't know the flavor of exactly what their apartment time is like together, but like usually, like that's the interesting arc of any relationship, is you go from a point where it's like, how do I spend every waking minute with you? It's important, to, you know, we have love and we have an agreement. Like, what does that look like after that part? And they are, you know, spared from that by tragedy.
Aww, that's a nice way to look at it. I'm sure that's how James Cameron pitched Titanic. It's August of 1988, so they're spending some amount of time deciding who to vote for.
Yes. Well, then that's like very in the air for sure. We also like our only person we ever see on television is Giuliani, which is a really interesting choice.
Yeah. I love that. That's wild. It's to remind everybody that he used to actually be able to speak quite well, and isn't that depressing? Time, you thief, etc.
Oh my god. So what happened, Sarah?
Well, you know, who should show up but good old Sully, who's like, if I can't have you, nobody will, basically. Or, you know, I'm gonna take you on the road forcibly with me, or whatever. There are no good options here, but who should show up but Lee with a plastic bag he loves to smother.
It's important to note that the most action-heavy scene in this movie, filled with tension, Lee has high above the knee jorts on, and I love that.
And so it's a wrestle to the death. They drag him into the bathtub, I guess, because if you're already kind of killing someone, you might as well minimize spill. It's very pragmatic. I've been doing this for a while, so... And Maren like rips his heart out, basically. Yeah. It's really cool. Mm-hmm.
Pretty great.
Yeah. But Sully has wounded Lee. He got him in the lung, I think.
Oof, yeah.
And so in a very kind of Tristan and Isolde kind of a thing, he's like, let's not go to the hospital. I just want you to eat me. Mm. Bones and all. And then she does. And then our last shot is a flashback to them sitting together in Terrence Malick Badlands fashion in the Great American West while she kind of spoons him topless from behind. Because we all know that heaven for some men is having boobs pressed into you from behind.
That's true. That's true.
And there you go.
That's bones and all.
I loved it. I loved this movie.
I'm so happy.
I had such a lovely time. And I feel like now that we've talked about what happens in it, the real question is like, what does it feel like?
You know, I was so struck when I saw it by how kind of hypnotic it sort of felt to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it was one of those movies that like the next few days I was thinking of, because it put me in a mood and took me to a particular like time and place. It was just so clear that it was made with a lot of heart and soul, a lot of thought, you know?
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, watching this movie, I was also struck by, I think anything with vampires, there's a lot of allegory and a lot of potential for queer allegory, which I definitely felt in this movie. You know, this idea of a community of drifters in the 80s who can't go home for reasons they don't want to get into, you know, and everything that we've been talking about.
Right. And have to learn from each other.
Yeah. And go into the corn sometimes. And then if stuff goes down, then no one can help you. But I feel like the question of why, because I would call this a vampire movie broadly, and I think the question of why that metaphor and imagery serves us so well and has worked so well for us for so long is really interesting to me, to the point where I would even say like vampires are real, because we have created a whole kind of mythology around them and they're as real to us as many things that actually do exist.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that with regard to allegories of queerness, with regard to like allegories of addiction, with regard to like finding just like subcultures generally, one thing that I don't know, I don't want to say that like subcultures are getting lost, because that is, there's a lot of ways that that's very true and there's a lot of ways that I think that that's not true, but like
everything's become a core or an aesthetic.
Yeah. Mm.
And people have been talking about this, right? That subcultures are becoming aesthetics.
Well, and the thing that I was talking with Kevin about earlier is like, with that comes like a particular form of like performative orthodoxy, where it's like there's a way to do it and there's a way to not do it. And that's sort of always shifting. And the shift is always to the benefit of the people who are kind of like, you know, there's a lot of people who mean it. And I'm not saying there aren't a lot of people who mean it, but then there's a lot of people who are performing it because it's a good way to like monetize it. Like there's all of this stuff that just comes with the way the internet works now and sort of like mass media works now. And what this speaks to, again, even if sort of like the queerness doesn't speak to you, or sort of, again, the people see parallels in communities who experience addiction or people who sort of come around that way in one way or another, is like one of the fundamental human experiences, if not lived necessarily, like by way of your interiority and your, the things that you feel and the things that you think, are being like, I'm not right for all of this. This wasn't made for me. I don't know how to exist within this. I feel alienation is one of our most regular most regularly felt feelings and themes in literature. And the vampire, you know, it is a really interesting way of looking at or dramatizing it, because it's a matter of acknowledging that and then also like trying to make it a little sexy, which is nice. Is it's like, what if alienation meant that it's sexy?
That's true. It's a sexy way to be alienated.
Yeah, absolutely. Or what if it came with at least some powers?
Yeah, there's a lot of, I've been exploited, and yet how can I avoid exploiting someone else? You know, which I think is, especially in that kind of Rust Belt setting, you know, it feels like you're in the container of capitalism itself, which is all about that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That everyone is kind of in this big soup of exploitation.
Yeah.
Everyone's dealing with the same trauma on some level.
The thing that feels missing too, or felt missing, I'm not going to say it feels missing. I don't know what it was like to be a kid in 1988. But the thing that is interesting to me that I think a lot about is like the issues that these kids are dealing with in this movie is, it's like our parents were fucked.
Yeah.
And we want to not be like our parents.
Right.
That was like the catch-all goal.
Mm-hmm.
And then they realized it not be, or at least Marin realizes it not being like your parents, like you still got to go out there and make it in some way, and making it means like killing people sometimes.
Totally.
And like now the question is less like, how do I not be like my parents, and like sort of a blunt catch-all, but like what values and goals were my parents not able to carry through because they never sort of like thought of that sort of thing? And how do I prioritize that while like maybe taking some of the good things about my parents? Like, it's like a slightly more nuanced conversation.
Totally.
But which just came from, you know, people having the conversation over and over sort of it, across generations. But yeah, like this idea where it's like, I don't want to be my parents. Great. Well, you still have to figure out how to be. And it turns out that the world, regardless of where you land, makes how to be very difficult.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to ask, you had a theory that Sully is just in Marin's imagination.
Oh, that's not mine. That is a popular theory about the movie, is that Sully is a representation of her hunger or addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Then who stabs Timothy Chalamet?
Her.
Oh.
Oh.
That like finally the hunger overtakes her, and she finally has to sort of do that, and then she eats him. I find it compelling. I don't think that that's where I land. I think like the thing that the theory enables that I don't like is, again, this like very of a pre-internet time where in order to get your knowledge of your subculture, you needed a problematic relationship with a man who is older than you.
Right.
And that's just how it used to work. Like, that's truly just how it used to work.
Uh-huh.
And especially in 1988, it feels really important that that is how the stuff was passed on.
Right.
Sarah, what stood out to you about this as someone who is new to it?
I mean, so, you know, movies feel different lengths, I think, based on more than just actual runtime. And this is a movie that felt really extraordinarily long to me in a good way, where you've been watching it for like an hour and a half and you feel like you've been watching it for an entire day because there's a lot of slowness in it. There's a lot of landscapes and tableaus and sort of scenes and sequences where people say not much or nothing. And I think that all creates a sense of space and a sense of feeling that you can kind of settle into this world and kind of start to understand it before you're asked to assimilate a lot of action or plot development. And I think just kind of the quietness of it and the security in its premise and, you know, not trying to over-explain, but also being cinematic about things. You got to give someone a handwritten letter before you attack them. And just, you know, I love horror or any kind of system of metaphor as a way of exploring something that feels very central and universal within the human condition, you know, and in this kind of just the search for love and intimacy and feeling the ability to give and accept love when you were raised without that seeming like an option. Like by being very specific, this movie feels like it's able to, Alex, like you've been saying, get at something very central to all humans, not just the cannibal kind.
Yeah, I love how, you know, there are a lot of movies that when they have a lot of ambiguity or when they have a lot of, you know, surrealism or just stuff that doesn't seem to all be adding up, you can get very frustrated. But this movie, to the extent that anything is ambiguous or you have mixed feelings about it, it all works. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I appreciate the extent to which I have such mixed feelings about all the characters and most of their choices and all of that. You know, I think that that's, I don't know, really kind of profound.
And I love, I'm at a point with reality that I feel like we all are with reality where it's like, I sometimes don't know if the thing we're talking about is real or is it real because we're talking about it. Like I don't, that's how I feel every day that I look at what we're all talking about. Mm-hmm. But like, I know one thing that whenever we have a lot of people talking about stuff, nuance gets lost is, do we like and appreciate, and can we still appreciate problematic characters? And I fucking love a problem. Like, I don't see the point.
What other characters are there? Do you want to watch a whole movie about Gallant? No, you want to watch a movie about Goofus?
I think a lot of people do. And like, I don't, and but to your point, yeah, I don't want to see that at all. And I, people are confused that like, because a character is going on the quote hero's journey, that they have to represent the morality of a hero.
Right.
And that is simply not true.
Also, the morality of a hero is not great historically. You know, like in Star Wars, you have to blow up the Death Star, which as they got into in Clerks may or may not have involved independent contractors.
I love that this movie does not offer one character because it's an examination of like the things we have to do to survive. And if we're ever honest about what survival looks like, it's a fucking mess. And it involves some exploitation along the way, no matter how freaking we try to be. And I love that every character is on that spectrum. And then that you have, and these are people that I've just met, I don't know. I find a way. I don't, and I should maybe examine this to understand what I'm attracting, but I find a way to find those guys that they met in the woods talking about being cannibals for fun.
Some of it is your shirts.
I run into those guys often, especially in LA now, but also in like rural Maine. And I like that we got to spend some time with those folks. Cause I feel like sometimes whenever I describe those kinds of people that I knew growing up, some people don't even believe me. And I'm like, no. Like this is a brand of guy.
Right.
So yeah, I like what this movie did was it put us in proximity to people who were absolutely lovable, some of them totally skeevy, some of them seemingly irredeemable, but you understand what their arc is without asking us to accept all of their choices.
Absolutely. One of the things I love in kink is when you play with the sacred and the profane and cannibalism from, you know, as in a loving way is like the Eucharist.
Oh, yeah. I can see doing something where, you know, ritualistically, I would just like lie on a table and then cover my torso with some nice skirt steak and then just have somebody eat it off of me and be like, mmm, delicious.
There you go.
Make some sauces.
There's got to be a club for that in Portland. There has to be.
Yes, it's called My Living Room. Actually, you might want to do it in the garage, you know, because then especially if you wanted people to line up and eat steak off of you.
Definitely. I feel like it's like a Stefan venue that we just described.
It's got everything.
And a human charcuterie board. What's a human charcuterie board? It's when a woman with self-esteem issues lies down on a collapsible picnic table and has people come toward her in a receiving line and eat steak bites off her torso.
That was perfect.
Thank you.
Oh my God. Kevin, you when we did talk about this initially, you've mentioned kink a couple of times, but you did say that you might see some parallels in that. Is that just the like the subculture stuff that we've talked about to this point?
Well, yeah, I mean, I went through like two different phases of my life where I felt like I was coming out to myself. And the first was when I was a little kid realizing I was gay. But then I had a lot of struggle in my early 40s, too, where I was introduced to a bunch of kinky folks and went to some kink camps, and stuff started opening up in me where I realized, oh, gosh, now I like a friend. The first time I went to a kink camp, he said, oh, be careful. It's a little bit like a Pandora's box. You never know what you might not like what you end up liking. So I went through a period where I was seeing a sex therapist and going through like, oh my God, I feel like I'm 9 years old again, you know, trying to figure out how I feel about stuff that most people would think is really weird. And so, yeah, this reminded me so much of those, oh my gosh, am I the only one? Or wait, how do people make sense out of this? And searching for folks with a, you know, who you could really talk about things with in an intelligent way. Then it also reminds me of the idea of sex addiction. You know, like I'll have conversations often with people about, oh my gosh, do I have way too much sex?
Yeah, you're like, should I be bones and alling this?
I mean, we have never arrived at the correct statistical amount as a society, right. You know, so.
Exactly.
It's gotta be a personal metric.
As I do, people know that I have people who listen to the show know I have two recreational activities, and one is reading old articles on newspapers.com. The other is watching old videos on archive.org. And I watched a presentation from what then? I don't know what year this was. Must have been the late 70s. It was a very stuffy group of people, but they were pitching a very progressive sex education for high schools. But it was not, for elementary and middle schools, but it was for curriculum development. They were talking about that and sort of how to develop curriculum. And they were talking about sex, obviously in the physical, but they were talking about just like how to talk with young people about sort of like where it plays into their life and dynamics and sort of like what the dynamic, like gender dynamics are in rooms and what various tensions mean. And I immediately was heartbroken that everyone, at least in this country, is robbed, not of sex education where they talk about sex, like you're going to have sex, because that's important, obviously, but just everything I see that's fucked up in one way or another about this country has to do with sexual repression. And Reich would say that it's the birthplace of fascism comes from the various forms of sexual tension and patriarchal structures and systems and stuff. And like the fact that that is a thing that you acknowledge is a part of your life, or like sometimes you look around and you're like, this all isn't for me, and you don't know what the not for me is. And it's the fact that like no one is talking about the thing that is on everyone's mind.
Yeah.
And so then you push people into these like little subcultures where they have to escape to where it's dangerous. Not the subculture inherently is dangerous, but like the fact that you have to go over into some corner and sort of like hide out, that's dangerous. It breaks my heart that we don't have like the conversation starting in schools to give people the skill set to understand like what the rest of everything is going to be like, because we're like, math is important. And that to me is like what this movie ends up speaking to in a big way, is it's like, something's wrong. It's not even just the way my parents were. It's like, just something's wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, why are we not talking about reality?
Yeah. I mean, it feels like these two young people, they're thrust into an adulthood where they almost have to be making horrifying mistakes.
Yes.
To figure out where the hell they really stand.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's the only way. And then even just like, if you think about like what your first loves look like, period, especially if you had the kinds of issues, not just these kinds of issues, but just these kinds of issues where you're like, do my parents even, I know they like love me in theory, but like they don't really know how to do it. And so then you look for someone to just do that. And it's your first testing grounds there. Like, it's so messy.
Really, like, yeah, the show is about the feelings that we don't want to have coming at us through movies in one way or another. And like, if you were to pitch, like, what about a movie about these two teenagers struggling with trauma and self-loathing who are on a road trip and they find love in themselves and stuff? You'd be like, God, no, I don't want to spend 2 hours on that. I'm going to die shortly. But if they're cannibals,
hell yeah,
I'm watching it. I'll have a feeling.
Right, right. It is those highest stake moments or those weirdest, most bizarre moments where we can then just like unpack a little bit of these emotional patterns that we have to deal with even in the most like mundane circumstances or that are always haunting us.
Yeah.
Right, for sure.
Well, and you know, and in this movie we have, and this is a paradigm we see a million times in a million different ways. It's what The Lion King is about. It's what Superman is about. I could go on, but like Lee is someone who's running from his past and running from his belief that he knows who he is based on a story that he won't tell to anyone. And then of course, the second you tell that story to someone, it changes meaning, right? And the fact that intimacy is what explodes open that vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And that before we die, we must at least truly live by being loved.
That's the end. It's so good.
That's amazing.
It's so good. Let's talk about daddies. I can't. It's so good. That's so good.
We all know based on this movie that your dad will abandon you and leave you a really long-winded tape. But who's the fucking daddy?
Or eat you.
Kevin, who's the daddy in this movie in your view?
Oh my goodness gracious, gosh. Jeez, I feel like it is a split personality between those two daddies. The daddy who flees. That reminded me of like Victor Frankenstein, you know, like abandoning his creature when her daddy left.
Totally.
And then his daddy tried to kill him, you know? So I feel like they're like the shadows of one another as daddies.
And really, you know, the basic forms of dad trauma, not to make it a binary, but you could say that two key groups at least are too much dad and too little dad.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get too much and too little at the same time, which is what I got, where it's like physically he's always there, but he's not available.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so well put.
Sully is an interesting, you know, like dad surrogate, you know, as that maybe he's a good mentor. Maybe he's a nice Socrates to my Plato. Or maybe he's grooming me to eat me.
And if that isn't a lot of people struggle with their father, what is it? Yeah. I'm not going to echo Sully, but I am just going to highlight Mark Rylance's performance. This is an actor I don't know much about. I can't name any one of his other performances. Even look, he was the BFG, apparently.
He won an Oscar.
Yeah.
For Bridge of Spies, a movie I've spent 10 years making jokes about and have not watched.
He was in Dunkirk, which like I know about and have seen, but only can remember like running away from bombs. I don't know. But this is like one of...
Everyone wears the same outfits in war movies. It's very hard to tell actors.
That's
apart.
Very difficult. Mm-hmm, this is one of the most affecting performances I've seen in like both horror and just like a regular movie. Like,
yeah, he does a lot of theater, and I think that that really comes through. You know, this is a weird, very lived-in performance, I think.
Sarah Marshall, who is your daddy in Bones and All?
Alex Steed. I'm going to give this one to Taylor Russell, who played Marin, who never seen in anything else to my knowledge, and who I guess love in this. I think that she does so much in quietness and by reacting and just kind of being with her and aligning with this character, I think just is what makes a lot of what makes this movie feel so full and makes you, I think, you know, that we're in a place beyond like good for her or she shouldn't be doing that. We just kind of we're here for the journey of what it's like for her to try and find a way to have some kind of a life. And it's an amazing performance. I loved her in this.
Yeah, I agree.
Kevin, how should people find you?
They can find me on the socials at the Kevin Allison, and Risk is anywhere you get your podcasts, also risk-show.com. And if you want to find out more about the state, since we're reuniting for even more shows this year, we're at the-state.com.
Amazing.
What a miracle.
Thanks for being with us. And I look forward to the next time.
Fabulous.
Oh, thank you so much. Bye.
All right, that's it for this week's episode of You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies. Thank you so much to Miranda Zuckler for producing this episode. Thanks, of course, to Kevin Allison for being in this episode. Miranda also edits the episodes, I should say. Thanks to Fresh Lesh for providing the beats that make our episodes sound so sweet. Thanks to Carolyn Kendrick, our founding and advising producer. Thank you for listening to this podcast, for rating and reviewing the podcast. Thanks for telling your friends about the podcast. Thanks for finding us on social media at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod. Thank you for supporting us on Patreon and Apple Podcast subscriptions, where you can listen to a bonus episode about Mannequin right now or very soon. You can hear an extended version of this very conversation. And I think that's it. I think that's all you need to know, right? Until next time, don't forget that you, my friend, are good. Thanks for talking cannibals in love with us. We're happy to have this time together. Take care, all.